This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, we want to do something we seldom have the bandwidth for, which is to sit down in the studio together to take a moment to reflect on 2019, what its impact has been on our country, our press, and, yeah, the show. We won't revisit all the major stories this year. Not every mass shooting, every political snafu, every weather disaster, or even every sign pointing to the republic imploding. I mean, it would take a couple of years to chronicle all of that. And anyway, that's not really our job.
So instead, we're going to return to a couple of the year's biggest themes, for us anyway. And let's start with one of the first episodes of 2019, which we called Everything is Fake. I spoke with New York Magazine senior editor Max Reed about the endlessly innovative ways the internet messes with our sense of how the world works.
We know that about 60% of traffic on the internet is human. Of the remainder, that's bots. And then there's this huge portion of bots that are pretending to be humans, saying, hello, I am a user and I would like to see this advertisement and click on it, and then I'm going to walk away from here.
So what happens when a facsimile internet, where fake people visit fake websites and generate fake data, begins to rival the size of the human internet? When the two become so enmeshed, they're indistinguishable. Max introduced me to the term the inversion, which is a take on what can happen.
So the inversion was a name that YouTube engineers gave to an event in 2013 when the site was under attack from fraudulent bot traffic. YouTube, like most platforms, has pretty sophisticated fraud detection systems, but those systems work by identifying real and fake traffic in part based on the percentages on the site. This attack was so large that it was brushing up against about 50% of the traffic, and the engineers were genuinely worried that their systems would start to regard real traffic as fake and fake traffic as real.
How? Why?
They work with machine learning. So they take samples of behavior, and they can say the majority of our users act like this and the minority act like this, and so this minority is likely robots.
So if the majority, at least on a given day, is robot,
the machines say, well, that's the legitimate traffic. That's the traffic that's supposed to be here. All these bots and all these silly humans who are trying to watch videos, we need to kick them off the service.
When was the moment of the inversion?
On YouTube itself, the inversion never quite happened. But for me, the inversion as a sort of metaphorical idea, I feel like I passed it this year. I am increasingly unable to tell the difference between the authentic and the inauthentic on the internet. Sort of everything you look at and everything you come upon starts to feel shifty. It's a vertigo-inducing experience.
You have also argued that the fakeness that we see today has also infected our politics. Our politics are fake. It's acrimonious, it's vitriolic, but fake?
Yeah. I think when we talk about sort of the ideal version of small d democracy, we think of it as a place where people come together to hash out disagreements in a rational and informed way. And what that requires is that everybody operate in good faith and that we believe that everybody operate in good faith. The problem with this sense of fakeness is that we no longer are able to assume good faith on the part of our interlocutors. On the one hand, you have liberals accusing Trump supporters of being Russian bots, of quite literally not being real people. And on the other hand, you have conservatives accusing liberals of so-called virtue signaling, which is this idea that they don't actually believe the things they're saying. They're just trying to win some kind of social competition to be the most virtuous person.
And you wrote, our politics have been inverted along with everything else, suffused with a Gnostic sense that we're being scammed and defrauded and lied to, but that a real truth still lurks somewhere.
Sure. I mean, I think if you look on YouTube, which is a kind of haven for far-right radicalization, you'll notice that the terms in which people talk often involve this sense that there is a big lie that these YouTube vloggers are going to teach you the truth behind. They call it red pilling from the Matrix, which is quite literally what we're talking about here, that there is a fake world. And if you take the red pill, you'll learn that feminism is a lie, that diversity is a scam. All these things are fake. And to me, this is just a reflection of the experience of being online, that you are constantly confronted with these worlds and ideas, these voices, these publications that you're not quite sure if they're real or if they're fake. And it can be incredibly corrosive to any sense of solidarity with other people.
Of course, we know that Americans are being scammed, defrauded, and lied to. But never before in modern memory has the White House itself been the epicenter of so much indiscriminate BS.
Kind of like a cat spraying the walls.
What a lovely image. Anyway, nowadays, not just because of the president, but because of our increasingly siloed media that profits from protecting us from unwelcome information, there's a lot that doesn't seem to make sense, but feels ominous, even apocalyptic. We all crave explanations for things we don't understand, so some of us fill in the blanks with conspiracy theories. We dug into that with Anna Merlin, author of Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power.
It used to be that far-right conspiracy theories went from fringe sites, some of them actual disinformation sites, to eventually places like Fox News, and that's sort of where they stopped. And now they have another stop, which is they go from Fox News to the president or from fringe sites like InfoWars straight to the president.
And this problem continues to get worse and worse. What is the logical extension of all of this out-of-control tinfoil hattery?
So one thesis is that especially state-backed disinformation sources like the ones we've seen in Russia, like the Internet Research Agency, that one of their goals is to make the information ecosystem so chaotic and so unstable and so unreliable that people start believing that the actual objective truth is not knowable and that they should stop looking for it. We know from a lot of research that exposure to conspiracy theories can sometimes lead people to inaction. Exposure to conspiracy theories about climate change, for instance, makes people less motivated to recycle or reduce their carbon footprint. Exposure to conspiracy theories about the political system being rigged makes people less likely to want to vote. And so the result of all of this really is the danger that we will simply give up participating and just sort of accept the way that things are. So, you know, one thing that we can actually do is not just continue engaging in things like the political system and engaging in fights against misinformation, but also identifying where that misinformation comes from and what the point of it is, what it's meant to do to us, who they benefit politically.
Take climate change. The president benefits by claiming that human-fueled global warming is a hoax, a Chinese invention, because it means he can continue to dismantle the EPA, deregulate, and work to upend state rules on pollution and conservation because he believes it will yield short-term savings, boost his popularity in the red states, ensure the continued support of the deep-pocketed fossil fuel industry, and help justify shirking international emissions agreements.
But you have to wonder, does the president really believe that climate change is just weather? That Ukrainians tried to stop him from winning the presidency? That his personal wealth actually exceeds $10 billion? Or doesn't he? Or does it matter? I spoke to Jeet Heer, the nation's national affairs correspondent, who devoted a piece to this question. Heer used a famous line from the 1983 film Scarface, some advice to an aspiring drug lord, to help us parse the president's position.
That's right. Lesson number two, don't get high on your own supply.
There's a very long academic tradition going back to the great Richard Hofstadter, who's one of the major 20th century American historians. He famously wrote about the paranoid style in American politics. And what he said was that the paranoid style comes from the fringes, from the far left and the far right.
But as he notes, Hofstadter's view has been challenged on the idea that conspiracy theories are the products only of people on the margins of power.
If you actually look at the sort of history of American paranoia and conspiracy theories, you often find that they're very elite figures who believe in them. I mean, things like the Red Scare were led by J. Edgar Hoover and Joseph McCarthy. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. Like if you have, you know, sort of powerful people high above society, it's very easy for them to try to blame any problems on outsider groups. And that has been the tradition, just as much as there's also been a tradition of populist groups using conspiracy theories.
So as you pondered the possibility that Donald Trump actually may have fallen into the same trap as Scarface and become intoxicated, you concluded that, in fact, he has.
Yes, I should actually qualify that a little bit by saying that with Donald Trump, the question of belief, I don't think applies in the same way that it does to other people. His view of truth is very instrumental. You know, the philosopher Harry Frankfurter made a famous distinction between lying and BS.
Mm-hmm.
The liar knows that they're lying, whereas the BSer doesn't care about the difference between truth and lying. So Trump, I think it's very clear from the last 50 years of his life that he doesn't really care about the distinction between truth and lies. And that makes it all the easier for him to grab onto these emotional narratives that support what he actually feels, which is persecuted. You know, whether something is actually factually true is not at all a concern. The question is it useful for him? And then if it is, he takes it up and it becomes part of him. The circle around him, though, definitely includes people who like seem to be really gung-ho about this and not in a manipulative way.
We've been dwelling in unreality for a while, so let's return to the real world. And yes, there is one. Does focusing too much on the current White House lunacy distract us from the kind of pervasive unfairness that's existed under every American president? I mean, it's easy to ignore if it's not wrecking your life.
True. Calling out Trump's absurdities is a breeze compared to staring down the systemic injustice that leads people to distrust the government and one another in the first place.
So, next up, the stories we tell ourselves that hold the nation down.
This is On the Media.